Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello there, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. In my experience as a journalist, if you ask people in my profession who they admire the most, an awful lot of them will say Michael Lewis. Michael is a legendary figure in long-form journalism and non-fiction writing. His books on everything from sport to science to high finance to the mysteries of modern government take very difficult subjects and turn them into readable page-turners with compelling characters and gripping plots. His latest book is somewhat unusual in that its central character has been all over the news for the last year or so and is currently the defendant in a New York courtroom in what, were it not for Donald Trump, would definitely be the most high-profile trial of the year. Michael Lewis, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me.
This book, which is called, I should tell our listeners, is called Going Infinite. It's about Sam Bankman-Fried. I'm sure some of our listeners will have heard about him. As I said, he's in a courtroom at the moment. But maybe you could just, for those who don't, give a quick pen picture of who he is.
If you've never heard of him before, he is the founder of a cryptocurrency exchange called FTX, founded in 2019. Before that, the founder of a crypto hedge fund called Alameda Research. He's 31 years old, born and raised in Palo Alto, California by two Stanford tax law professors, to the bewilderment of his parents. At the age of 28, became the richest person in the world under 30. Forbes magazine had him, as a result of his crypto exchange, worth $22.5 billion. So goes from nothing to $22.5 billion faster than anybody has ever done that. And then last November, the cryptocurrency exchange collapses when there is a run on the deposits and the deposits aren't there. And so he went from being maybe the most sensational wealth creator in history to one of the most sensational financial scandals in history.
So it is a story of high drama, and that's why I say it's a little bit different from some of your other books. I mean, we have talked about this previously, and you talk about how you find characters. You go out and you find characters, and those characters both essentialize kind of key things about the way modern life is and tell us something about it, but they're sort of fascinating in themselves, and you become very enmeshed with them. You spend a lot of time with them, and then you kind of bring them to our attention, or at least that's my experience as a reader. Very often it's somebody who I haven't heard of, and there's a fascinating story about them. This is different, though, because this guy was incredibly famous when you met him for the first time, and his story has only got more and more high octane.
You know, it's funny. For me, just writing the thing, the biggest difference was that a lot of my readers would know who he was.
Yeah.
And normally I have characters the readers have no idea who they are. I mean, it's maybe not completely true, but that's sort of true. When I met him, you know, I met him just accidentally. A friend asked me to evaluate him for him. A friend who was going to do a business deal with him. And I'd never heard of him. In September of 2021, I never heard of him or FTX. It was a recent sensation, and it was based in Hong Kong, and I wasn't paying all that much attention to cryptocurrencies. So he was a stranger to me when I met him. But the notoriety does present these challenges, because some readers bring a lot of baggage to it when they read it.
Yeah, we might come to actually some of that.
Totally.
But when you met him then for the first time, I mean, you told your friend, yeah, go all in, give him the money.
My friend said, should I do this business deal with him? And after 2 hours with Sam Bankman-Fried, I said, what could go wrong?
Why did you say that? What was it in those two
hours? Well, in the first place, I knew that my whatever I thought wasn't going to make all that much difference. He was going to do what he was going to do anyway, so it was kind of loosey-goosey. But I thought he was, for someone who was in his position, shockingly transparent, open about his affairs, easy. He hadn't been, you know, what I was looking for, there were two things I was looking for. One I was looking for is this person seemed like he's been warped by his success. Is this another pompous billionaire? And one of the disarming things about Sam Bankman-Fried is he just didn't let that happen. He was just he was
so he was authentic.
He was authentic.
Would that be fair?
He didn't know how to be anything but himself. And people who knew him in high school, he'd been a total loner in high school. I mean, an unbelievably isolated childhood. But people who knew him in high school were bewildered that he'd got himself in this position. And when they met him later, they assumed, well, he must have changed. He must have found a way to learn how to talk to people and things like that. And when they saw him, they said, no, he didn't change. The world changed around him.
Because his presentation, his public presentation, is of a sort of an overgrown teenage boy with very limited social skills.
And that's true. He learned social skills. He learned some social skills. But, you know, he was dressing and he was just his mannerisms, all that. The talking a mile a minute, not listening that much to what you have to say. He was odd. He was an odd person, but he seemed very much himself. And the other thing, when I learned what his business was, the constellation of his affairs, he had this crypto exchange on which, unlike like a stock exchange, the customers actually deposited their money, and so they held that money. And he had on the side of it his own trading firm. The business questions I asked were about the conflicts of interest between those things, and the conflicts of interest that everybody was, it wasn't just me, that everybody was kind of thinking was a problem, were, is this trading firm being given preferential advantage on the exchange in the same way that high-frequency traders in the United States are given preference on stock exchanges? Mm. It's legalized in the States. It's like it's built into the system. It's outrageous. But the people who were investing in this were worried that that kind of thing was going on. No one imagined that the deposits from the exchange were just in the hedge fund. So he explained to me that the structure of crypto markets was different from the structure of stock markets, and you actually couldn't rig the trading in the same way because it took place in the cloud. It was very hard to predict the order of trades, for example, that came back out of the cloud. The problems that existed in the stock markets were very hard to replicate in the crypto markets. So that was the one question I asked him early on, and he satisfied my concern.
Yeah, I have to admit, I still struggle with the whole blockchain, crypto. How the hell does this world work? What underpins it? What are the laws?
Well, that's all true. That's a whole other subject. Crypto. So his business didn't really depend. I mean, it depended on the existence of crypto. If the whole crypto world collapsed and crypto was worth zero, his exchange would be worth zero. But he had just built a casino for crypto to be traded in. And at the time I met him, the value of all crypto in the world was, I don't know, $3 trillion, and now it's maybe down to a trillion. It's still a lot. And if he hadn't screwed up his exchange, it would still be a very valuable business because people still want to trade this stuff. They need a casino. The business is come trade here and we take a little piece of each transaction. It's sort of the safest business to be in, much safer than like buying Bitcoin and watching it go up and down.
Sure, because you're just taking this very, very large sums.
That's right. And at their peak, FTX was trading $250 billion a month of crypto. So it just seemed if you're going to be in that racket, that seemed to be the way to be in that racket rather than just owning crypto.
And then what happened was, perhaps related to certain changes that were happening in the global economy as well, rising interest rates, you know, the shape of the economy was changing in the post-COVID era. But some doubts crept in among some of the people who were using the exchange. Those doubts were encouraged by competitors, maybe, and a run started on FTX. I suppose a little bit like a bank run, except I think an exchange works different from a bank, doesn't it?
So exchange should work different from a bank. Mm. You're not lending your money to the exchange. You can. there was a mechanism. You could tick a box and say, here, you can lend out my money and you'll pay me a rate of interest. And some small fraction of the people who had their money on the exchange, and there was maybe $16 billion on the exchange that was supposed to be held on behalf of customers.
Yeah, it gives an idea that $16 billion is a small fraction.
Yeah, but that money should have just been in kind of cold storage on the exchange.
Okay.
And what happens the minute doubt creeps in, and doubt creeps in the crypto world, when it creeps in, it doesn't creep, it runs. And there's been so many examples of these institutions unraveling that people are on kind of a hair trigger alert for a problem. So
because the whole world, just sorry to interrupt, but the whole world you describe here and the talent which this guy brings to that world is the ability to make these split-second decisions and for most of them to be correct. They don't all need to be correct,
well,
but everything is sort of hyper-accelerated.
Everything's hyper-accelerated, but in part because it's not regulated, right?
Yeah.
If there's a run on a bank in the United States, the government can stand up and stop it with a sentence. You know, your deposits are protected. There's nobody in crypto to do that. So there's no regulator. There's no grown up in the room. So once it starts, the panic moves very fast. Mm. And they had a problem. And this is with the law. This is why he's likely going to go to jail. Is the money? There were lots of deposits. The depositors had not given permission for FTX to lend out. That FTX had lent out, and they lent it to Sam Bankman-Fried's private hedge fund. It essentially extended a free loan without the knowledge of the depositors to his hedge fund, and it was complicated how that happened, but it happened, and the hedge fund,
is that fraud?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, it's fraud. Hmm. This is funny. It's fraud. Fraud, you have to prove intent. So it's fraud if he intended to do this. The only argument you could make that it isn't fraud is he hadn't intended to do this. And it's very hard to argue that he hadn't intended to do this, but leave that to one side because where it gets kind of interesting was, at what moment? Even the money's in the wrong place. The money's in the wrong place because it was mostly historical reasons. When FTX was created as an exchange in 2019, it couldn't get bank accounts. So if you wanted to put your euros into crypto and you were wiring your euros to FTX, you couldn't. Alameda Research, his hedge fund, did have bank accounts. So you wired it to Alameda Research, and $8.8 billion piles up that way inside of Alameda Research and never gets moved over to FTX. So it never got to FTX in the first place. What he's – up until about, I don't know, probably April of last year, there was more than sufficient funds inside of Alameda Research so that if – you asked for your deposits. Everybody asked for their deposits back. They could have repaid them. Mm. Crypto collapses in May and June of last year. And Sam Bankman-Fried in his hedge fund has put a lot of money into illiquid investments. $5 billion of venture capital investments, for example, that just they can't be easily unwound. So when the run happens in November, there's some money still there, like the $16 billion, they repay five right away, but they freeze it with about $11 billion still to be repaid. And as we sit here now, this is why it gets so messy. There are apparently $8.6 billion missing of customer deposits. However, the bankruptcy people have found $7.3 billion of it in liquid assets. This isn't going and clawing it back. It was there. And they're sitting on a pile of investments that seem to have well more than $1.3 billion in value.
So it's people might all get their money back.
People might all get their money
possibly.
Back. Very possibly, I think. If you talk to – there's a market in these claims. Like if you – I'm a depositor. I had a couple of $1,000 on the exchange just to see how it worked. And – if I wanted right now to get out of that claim, I could get 40 cents on the dollar. But that doesn't excuse it or actually have, oddly, have any effect on his legal future. He's quite likely to go to jail for a long
time. A crime is a crime, regardless of whether there was a real victim who suffered in the end.
It's funny. So it just makes it a little hard. It's just a little different than, oh, he stole the money, because the money's still there. He borrowed the money without telling them and put it at, what he did is he put it at risk without anybody, without asking their permission.
I want to give our listeners just a sense of just how weird this world was,
and the character himself.
Yeah. The character and the world that he created around him. He set up these companies, first of all, in Hong Kong. They couldn't really operate in the United States because of financial regulations there. Shifted them all to the Caribbean.
In the fall of 2021.
Yes, and just the description of, there are these kids, basically. They're mostly in their late 20s. They're making these billions of dollars. They're living in these, they're living like kind of in kind of college student style, out of sleeping on beanbags in these expensive penthouse suites. They are, a lot of them are committed to this particular philosophy of a certain particular kind of philanthropy.
This is important. Mm. This is important. And, you know, I found myself in the history of my books coming to Europe on book tours, and I often find myself telling Europeans I'm telling them some weird story about something that's happened in America, and then we're exporting to them. The America is the source of the oddness. This is a case where the English are actually responsible. That effective altruism, this philosophy, is born at Oxford on the heels of the financial crisis, roughly almost exactly the same time that cryptocurrency is created, And the idea behind effective altruism, it starts pretty simply and kind of innocuously. Oxford professor named Toby Ord makes the point that at very little cost to himself, he could do dramatic good for people he doesn't know, children in Africa. And if he makes a calculation, if he took half his salary for the rest of his career and put it and effectively donated it, he could prevent 80,000 African children from blindness. And this begins a raft of calculations about what the most efficient way to spend your philanthropy and what your duty is. If you can save a life with a dollar, how could you possibly spend that dollar on a Starbucks latte, you know, kind of thing? Mm-hmm. And they spin up an argument that implicitly is that the way to lead your life is to maximize the number of lives you save with your charity. This morphs in a few years into a new idea, which has odd effects on Wall Street, called Earn to Give. And these philosophers go out and actually proselytize this idea to kids in the elite colleges who might go make a lot of money. And they say to these kids, if you are at all attracted to the idea of effective altruism, to sort of maximizing the good you're going to do for others on the planet, and your first step might have been to, say, become a doctor to go save lives in Africa. Reconsider that thought. Instead, if Wall Street, say, has an appetite for your skills, go to Wall Street, make as much money as you can, and pay 20 doctors to go to Africa. So maximize your earnings and then direct the earnings to the people who will actually do good. And this idea, it collides with Sam Bankman-Fried when he is a junior at MIT, and he swallows it hook, line, and sinker. And it isn't just him. If there are the argument, and it's a kind of mathification of figuring out how you want to move through life. You accept the principle that you're here on Earth to maximize the good to others. The best thing you can do for others is save lives, is extend lives, their health. And the most efficient way to do it is by making as much money as possible and donating it as effectively as possible. Then it just becomes a numbers game. And this idea appeals to people who are quantitative people and people who—
Well, take Sam Bankman-Fried, for example. People who in every other walk of life, it seems, entirely lack empathy. There's this disjunction there between this life commitment to doing nothing but good, and on the other hand, really being entirely uninterested in other human beings.
This is a generalization and not true for all of them, but it is very curious how little the effective altruists I met cared that much about other people personally, and how much they cared just about humanity. And with one exception, they cared about each other. It becomes a cult is too strong a word, but it had cult-like qualities. Cult is too strong a word because it was a little bit of an anti-cult, because the spirit of the cult is we're driven by pure reason.
It's extreme rationality.
Extreme rationality. So if you can make a better argument about what we should be doing here, the cult might change. And and it did change. It changed soon, right after Sam Bankman-Fried becomes a member of it. It isn't – someone makes the argument, and I can't remember who floats this argument in the first place. And the cult changes almost with a – it was almost like a bloodless coup of an idea. Someone says, well, look, we're trying to maximize the number of lives we save. Let's turn our attention to existential risk to humanity, things that might wipe out humanity for all time. An engineered pathogen that's so diabolical it kills everybody. Artificial intelligence off the leash finds a way to destroy us. Climate change, maybe. An asteroid strike. They make a list of these things. And they assign probabilities to any of these things happening. And where these probabilities come from are the, you know, anybody's, they seem preposterous to me, but they're numbers that are out there and they argue about the numbers. But once you do that, once you say, I don't know, there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that, or 1 in 10,000 chance that artificial intelligence might wipe out mankind. And you do the math that wiping out all of mankind is wiping out a lot of people, even if it's a low probability, and it's all people for all time. How can you pay attention to living human beings in Africa when you could spend your time instead reducing the risk of that? And so all of their attention and all of their giving starts to move to that. And that's where you really – the whole thing jumps the shark in a way that
– Yeah, it really does. It's funny because I was finishing the book this week and I was also reading and writing a little bit about a billionaire called Chuck Feeney who died this week.
Who made wonderful
gave
character.
Gave away all his money.
Is he Irish?
All his money. Irish-American.
There we
and
go.
And he gave a lot of money in a lot of countries, including Ireland, more than €1 billion in Ireland, which is definitely by far the biggest act of philanthropy ever in this country, to universities and hospitals, and ended up living in a rented apartment with a pull-down bed.
Right.
And that, I'm not a great fan of philanthropy as a, you know, I'd prefer if people paid their taxes and people could then make political decisions about what to do with the money. But that was a pretty good example of philanthropy at its best.
Yeah, I agree.
This kind of, I don't buy it. It looks like bullshit to me. I mean, it really does, you know?
It's like
precocious 12-year-olds sitting around, you know, making up things in their heads.
Really. So, if you've read the book, you see I don't make a great deal of effort to defend it, and I make some fun of it. But it's let's just for fun, just for the hell of it, rather than you and me just ripping into it. Let me try to just defend it a little bit. Sure, would be nice if people with vast resources did address the threat of pandemics. Governments aren't doing it. Even after COVID, something very obvious to do. And the very obvious thing to do is to create a kind of global weather service for disease prediction and control. Could be done. It's expensive. So sure, it would be nice if someone did that. Sure was interesting that these people identified artificial intelligence as a problem years ago, 5-6 years, and thinking about it and now all of a sudden it's front of mind. You know, they were ahead of that. It wasn't useless. They were doing what they were doing. It was monomaniacal. And I agree. What happens to me when I hear it is I think, well, you've kind of divorced the act of helping other human beings from the feeling for other human beings.
Yeah.
You've turned life into a math problem.
Sure.
And who does this? It's kind of people are on the spectrum.
There's a lot of that in the book. That's what's going on here.
Yeah. It's sort of like this is a way through life. And last order of defense, where are these people going to go in their heads if they aren't here? Like where do people like this end up as their role, the kind of role they play, their relationship to humanity if they aren't in this space? They tend to become libertarians. They tend to be Peter Thiel. They tend to be, I don't care about other people at all, and I'm going to live for myself. And that's that, you know. And they elevate selfishness to a kind of principle or a religion. And given a choice, I think I'd prefer the.
Okay, effect. I can buy that. I don't think it's a great choice, but another way of looking at it might be that they're a symptom of a very modern disease, which is on the one hand, people are incredibly frustrated that it seems impossible to address these big questions. There's a kind of sclerosis in government and things. You've written about some of those subjects in the past. And on the other hand, you have this creation of this new super elite of super rich people who accumulate these unimaginable sums of money.
Very fast.
Very fast. And kind of assume these kind of godlike properties in their own visions of themselves, that just because they managed to take a piece of technology and disrupt the taxi industry, that therefore they can change the world for the better, you know? So all these Musks and Bezoses and all the rest of them, Sam Bankman-Fried almost looks like the next stage in the evolutionary process.
Perfect description.
That. Yeah.
I think this is absolutely true. And you're getting at, you know, one of the things that it just seems problematic about modern life and modern capitalism, that this kind of the relationship, the power of the individual in relation to the institutions have gotten out of whack, that you have people doing things that really should be institutionalized. Elon Musk is a great example. War in the Ukraine, and the Ukrainians are launching a counterattack with drones on the Russians, and it's up to Elon Musk to decide whether he enables Starlink so that the drones can function.
Yeah.
This is insane. You know, that he's more important than the U.S. State Department in this war. That's a microcosm of the issue. And Sam Bankman-Fried was gunning to play that role in other spheres of life. So I'm not defending the world the way it is. I'm not really even defending effective altruists. But if you force me to make the argument, I'd say, well, at least it's better that they care about humanity than they don't at all. And when people are coming at problems from a different angle, maybe they'll generate solutions that you might not otherwise see. And until governments get their act together, it's better that somebody's thinking about this and throwing money at it than nobody.
I should say that the book is very funny at times. In fact, it kind of reads as a satire, almost in the style of Tom Wolfe, who's a sort of forebear of yours, of your sort of writing, of kind of money and power and hubris, so and how they work.
It's funny you say this, because after my first 2 hours with Sam Bankman-Fried, my first thought was, this is walking social satire, that this is what he's going to enable me to do, that it's preposterous. You know, this kid who in any other time in history would have been like a high school math teacher, who is clearly not understood by the people who are doing business with him and doesn't particularly care about them, and has become overnight, because he has this pile of $22.5 billion, the center of everybody's attention. And he's touching all these systems and stress testing all these systems. He's going to put $1 billion into, he becomes Biden's second biggest donor. He's going to put $1 billion into the presidential election. He's talking about paying Donald Trump $5 billion not to run for president and negotiating with the Trump people about this.
Do you think that could have worked?
No, it wouldn't have. You know,
no, I don't think so.
You know what would have happened, right? What would have happened?
He'd have taken the money and run anyway.
That's exactly what he would have done. Yeah. It's unenforceable. It's probably illegal. It's probably, because I think it's a bribe. But and they hadn't gotten that far with, but he had other effects. And so I saw this, that he was insinuating himself into not just American politics and not just global philanthropy and not just global finance, sort of global culture, you know, that, and celebrities wanted to be his friend. Wall Street tycoons wanted to hear what he had to say.
So obviously that's partly because he's the richest young person in the world. And also because, and this is very Tom Wolfish, he's the new thing.
That's right.
Isn't he?
You know. He's the new thing. And nobody understands this crypto force. Everybody's, it could just be mostly a tulip bubble craze.
Yeah.
I mean, there's another thing going on there. It's not just a tulip bubble craze. There is a technology there. But on top of it, a tulip bubble craze happened. And everybody's worried about missing out on that. And my interest in crypto actually was galvanized only by it. When it was just crypto and there was a few billion dollars of it and people were trying to sell it as something that was going to change the world, and it didn't seem to me it was going to change the world anytime soon, I wasn't that interested. When there's $3 trillion of it and you had people who had $22 billion fortunes, I thought, this is going to have social consequences.
Yeah, and one of the things that's so funny in the book, you know, as always happens when large amounts of money appear, you know, the carrion birds and the scavengers start circling, and, you know, he spends money on ludicrous things. There's a hilarious sequence with Anna Wintour of Vogue where she's trying to get him, I think, basically just to fund the Met Ball, as far as I can see.
Yeah, so this person who is the single worst dressed person in the history of humanity, who looks like he's fallen out of a dumpster, is thrown onto a Zoom call. I was in this was a scene that happened very early on in my travels with Sam Bankman-Fried, that we're in a hotel room in Los Angeles. He says, there's this person I'm supposed to have a Zoom with. I say, can I just sit and watch? And I sit off to one side, and onto his screen pops Anna Wintour, editor of Vogue magazine, the queen of global fashion. Mm-hmm. And Sam has no idea who he is.
He's never seen The Devil Wears Prada.
Never seen The Devil Wears Prada. Is Googling her while he's talking to her. And at the same time, whenever she's on the screen on the Zoom, he's trying to let her do all the talking, because he's playing this video game called Storybook Brawl.
Which he does all the time. Like, he'll do it even when he's doing live television interviews. He'll be
on his
video,
Storybook Brawl. Mm-hmm. And so you're hearing Anna Wintour describe in grand terms this Met Gala and how important it is to the world and blah, blah, blah. And on the screen, a minotaur is attacking a dragon. And trees with hatchets are coming out of the left. And blood is flying everywhere. And the game's going so fast. And Sam is focused on that. And saying words to her that kind of track the conversation, but it's clear he's not really even listening until she'll trick him. She'll say, like, what do you know about the Met Gala? And it'll go, oh, interesting question. And he'll hit a button and up pops the Wikipedia page of the Met Gala. And he'll skate through that. And then the minute he's said enough that she'll take over, he's back to his game.
So he's basically the irritating teenager at the dinner table who won't lift their head from their phone.
It's worse. Yes, and it actually, his brain, I think his brain couldn't function doing one thing. It was always, it had become addicted to distraction. And it took me a while to get used to being with him. He can't do what you and I are doing right now. He would be shuffling a deck of cards. He would be looking at his phone. When he's on a witness stand, he's going to have to sit there and do one thing. You'll see a physical discomfort because his brain has gotten so used to being two places at once. And the way I interpreted it was he kind of needed two realities to function in the world. That he needed this reality of a fantasy life, a video game. At the same time, he's playing this other game, which is real life, which he's decoded and reconstructed as a video game. What he's doing in business and his interactions with people are a game. He's gamified it. When he's a kid, he doesn't know. He has no ability to make facial expressions. It's one of the things. One of the things he said he most weirdly couldn't do. He learns with a mirror the kind of facial expressions you need to do to make other people feel comfortable so he can have social interaction.
I suspect they're not that comforting, those facial expressions.
They're not. I tell you, it's not that bad. I mean, but I catch him at a later stage. When I meet him, he's 29 years old. When you talk to people who knew him when he was 17, it was bad. And he said, you know, he was born without the usual complement of human feelings. And he knew it. It's like a kind of absence in himself. And he replaced the mechanisms that the most of us have, and mostly these emotional mechanisms, with math and reason and calculation to get through life.
Would it be too pretentious to describe what you're describing there as he's a kind of an avatar of modernity, or of a, to me, slightly terrifying future where everybody lives at least two or multiple different lives, and the one which they live in this physical world is perhaps not the most important one.
Like a matrix.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I did think that a little bit. I also thought, when I was thinking about the kind of breadcrumbs the reader might follow to their own conclusions, what I loved about the story was there were so many ways a reader who read this might respond, that it's fun to maximize the volatility of the reader's response. So it's sort of like maximizing the volume of shouting in a book club that has to read the book, that eight people will read it and they'll be shouting at each other different things about what the book means or what it says or what we should think about it. One of the things that the story kind of jumps out of the story is a foreshadowing of dystopic artificial intelligence. Like one AI dystopia is that we give AI instructions to do something, but we don't tell it exactly how to do it. And we just say, this is your mission, go figure it out. And it does it in a horrible way. So you tell it to go make you a reservation at your favorite restaurant for tomorrow night, and it goes out and it sees that the restaurant's fully booked, and it starts murdering people to open up a table for you. This feels a little bit like what Sam Bankman-Fried did. It's sort of like on a mission, save humanity from these existential risks, generate $1 trillion so you can push it into these problems, but no guardrails about how you do it, and no feeling about the consequences, the human consequences about how you do it. That was one. I wondered if some readers were going to come away with that feeling. Like, I just saw some trial run of a weird future.
Something I mentioned at the start was that this is, you know, this is unusual for you to do a story that is so much in the public glare, in the public moment. Mm. And I've been looking with interest at reactions to the book mm-hmm. since it was published, almost day and date with the start of the trial, which I presume was intentional. And there's, you know, you've been the subject of a lot of these. You have kind of put yourself in the spotlight in a way that you were that you haven't always been, and it's caused people to look at your methods, you know, of the way you approach telling these stories, your relationship with your subjects, and some of them to be quite critical.
Yeah.
What's it like to be sort of in the mix in a way that you aren't usually?
Expected in this case.
Was it?
Okay. Yeah, because it was a lynch mob for him. You know, the mob had already decided instantly just how guilty he was and why he was guilty, and he was a villain.
Yeah.
And you couldn't be close to the situation. Not just me, but the people who worked around him, who lost all their savings, they had the same feeling. They read the book and say, yeah, that's him. That it was more nuanced than this is just like a crook. He wasn't born a crook. And so I knew that if I introduced that nuance in a narrative, the people who had their own narrative based on a lot less information than I had were going to be outraged. I knew that was going to happen.
So they think you're advocating for him. In fact, in some cases, they think you're part of the defense team.
Yeah, really. Which is silly, because the only people who are going to, in the courtroom, who are going to get actual facts out of this that are useful to them are the prosecutors. And there's going to be stuff that's almost surely going to come up in the next couple of weeks from the book, and the prosecutors will raise it. The jury aren't allowed to read the book. What I did that was radical was I withheld my judgment. I didn't withhold judgment. I just let other characters express the judgment, people who were closer to the situation even than I was, and they were harsh on him. So the two characters at the end who worked inside the firm who deliver just withering judgments of Sam Bankman-Fried. It's just not me. I just let them say it. But the reaction, I've had a similar reaction a couple of times to books. When I published Moneyball, there was a war for the first few weeks about that. And it was because there was a tribe of old sports writers and scouts and people who thought they knew the sport and were offended by the idea that some outsider had come in and written this story that suggested there was a new way to do this or a new way to think about it. And it was ugly. It was just confined to the American sports world, though. When I wrote Flash Boys, there was a small but extremely well-funded sort of machine to attack the story funded by high-frequency traders. It was like, he doesn't know what he's talking about. The stock market's not rigged like this. Those were different experiences because there was some counterweight in the culture to it. And there's a counterweight here too, but it's a different kind of counterweight.
And the world was different then as well. The way that the discourse operates is different.
The noise would have been, I bet, with Moneyball, quite similar if Twitter existed the way it does now. It would have been ugly and nasty.
It's prompted some quite thoughtful pieces as well. I mean, I read a piece in the New Yorker. You probably read it, or I don't know if you did.
So I don't read any of the reviews.
You don't look at this stuff. Yeah, no, you're probably right.
But the New Yorker's apparently, that's probably a more considered thing because it's came out 7 days after the book was published instead of 20 minutes after the book was published. The book was embargoed, so people couldn't read. We're talking about a book that was published 11 days ago.
I know.
And you couldn't get your hands
on it. And then it's Hot Take City everywhere.
50 unverified reviews.
I'm going to read the New Yorker quote because I think you might find it interesting. In any Michael Lewis book, this writer says, the immense satisfaction of narrative and detail are the notable, are the table stakes. What differentiates this one, which may one day be regarded as either the pinnacle or the nadir of his career, is his personal exposure in the reputational market. Do you think there's any truth in that?
Not really. Because I don't, it's not like I say he's innocent or guilty.
Sure.
You know, so I don't render a verdict. Yeah. I leave it to them.
I mean, I think we can take it that the New Yorkers read the book, but most of the people creating heat around this probably haven't even got to read the book yet, have they?
Correct. Correct. And most the loud noise, the loud bang, you probably didn't hear it here, but the loud bang that went off a week ago Tuesday was a bang that was uninformed by the actual reading of the book. It was informed by a TV show. So 60 Minutes, the big television show, did a big takeout on the book 2 days before the book came out. And I think there were two things I said that triggered a lot of people. And one that you can argue about, and one you can't. The first one was that FTX was actually a gold mine. It was actually a solid business, and he screwed it up with his hedge fund on the side. That's one of the things that's so strange about this story is that his wealth was all wrapped up. His $22.5 billion was his stake in FTX, and this mad gambling operation he had on the side should never have been there. And if it hadn't been there, FTX would still be up and running and it would be fine. And that's so made it different. It's distinguishing it from, say, Bernie Madoff, that where there is no real business there. So that's not to say this isn't a financial scandal. It's to say it's a different kind of financial scandal. And that bothered people because they'd already put him in the Bernie Madoff box. And they didn't like that it was going to be more complicated. The other thing I said was, the television presenters asked me, did he steal the money? And I thought that's not quite right because the money's still there mostly. It seems like maybe even more than the money's still there. What he did is he granted himself a free loan without telling people. And so it was that doesn't make it right, but it's just different. And in saying it's different, it just offended a lot of people who had staked their own reputations on their view of this thing without knowing as much as I knew. That caused a little kerfuffle.
It's also, isn't it? It's the world's first great Gen Z scandal. One of the notable things about all these characters when things fall apart is they all run home to their parents.
Well, so I think it is the world's. I think it's the world's first financial scandal where everybody involved was when it blew up in their parents' basement the next night. It's just different. Like it's what I don't understand is why people don't take pleasure in what is different about it, rather than try to force it into some pre-existing narrative. Try to see it for what it is, rather than what they would like it to be. And because what it is still bad. You want him in jail, you're going to get him in jail. I'm not going to keep him out of jail. He may go to jail for the rest of his life. There's nothing I can do about that. But how you feel about it might be a little different if you know the whole story. And for whatever reason, that's threatening. And I haven't quite put my finger on why that's threatening. As to my methods, let's talk about that a minute, because this is interesting to me. My methods here are no different from my methods every other book. It's just this person is radioactive.
Subject changes, the method remains exactly the same.
I worm my way into these people's lives, and I become invisible on their wall, and I watch. And I don't, when I go in...
I get the impression he wouldn't have noticed you anyway.
No, he's exactly right.
He's no interest.
He was perfect for this.
Yeah.
He was perfect for this, because he was so indifferent to me. And that the minute the algorithm said, okay, he's in, then it moved on. It didn't ever reevaluate my presence. And I spent a year and 2 months just observing and interviewing not just him, but all the people around him and the venture capitalists who lent him money and all that stuff, building it, trying to figure out what the story was before it blew up. And I didn't start writing it till January. So I didn't figure out what I was doing until after everything
was. Is that a very tight deadline in terms of your working processes? Or?
It's exactly the same as every book has taken.
Okay.
That normally it's the unknown is how long it's going to take me to the point where I'm confident to write that to me is when I know the end of the book. Like when I know how the story ends, I know how to start it. And that can take that process can take years, and sometimes it can take 6 months. The writing is always about 6 months. I can usually tell the publisher, I'll give it to you in 6 months. And I've never missed that. The books are all about the same length, 700, 800 words a day. Once I get writing, I can do that. So I started at the end of January and I finished it August the 15th. And I felt actually it was kind of a leisurely pace. I didn't feel rushed at all. And when I was done, I had one thing that was unusual about this. Normally when I'm done, I'm not looking at the cutting room floor and agonizing about what I left out because normally I see, well, that material down there, it's kind of second rate. Or I'm not going to – the material on the cutting room floor was – there was a rollicking second comic novel in it. There was just stuff that just didn't – it didn't need to be in the story. The story kind of told me what needed to be in it. But there was just so – the material was so good. And that feeling, it's what you dream about as a writer. You dream that you were limited not by the quality of the material but just by your own powers. And that's what I felt. I'm limited by my powers.
And you have a podcast on the same subject. There's about 20 episodes or so of it up, I think.
It's a podcast in which I'm missing in action. And it is a grotesque act of misrepresentation to even call it my podcast.
Okay.
Because it's being done by my producers because I'm out here yakking away about this book.
Your voice is still heard.
I don't have time to talk on my podcast, but I'm going to start to re-engage with it.
Yeah, I heard you complaining to your producer because you can't even be at the trial, which is where you should be right now, but you're out plugging the book.
So I do have a podcast called Against the Rules, which narrative nonfiction, it's scripted.
Yeah.
That's different. That thing I do throw myself into and I love doing it. But this is a Insta podcast on the trial, and my producer is in the courtroom every day making me envious because, you know, to me, so Sam is the main character of the book, but there are seven or eight other characters who are subsidiary characters who are drawn.
And very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And half these people at least, and maybe all of them, are going to take the stand. And to see your characters in that kind of cauldron, it's almost like seeing characters from a novel come to life in the world. There's something about it, and I really would wish I was there. And I'm probably going to go at the end of October and sit in the courtroom.
And I suppose then I have to ask finally. I mean, is this edition the ending of Sam for you? Because obviously the story is just
there's
about to take a major twist.
There's a second
story.
So I thought that this story was the rise and fall of this dream, this kind of fantasy he had about what life was going to be.
Mm.
And when that collapsed, that was the end of that story. And the trial has felt like a whole separate, maybe little book. It certainly had an addendum at the end, but it feels like its own story. And just see how it plays out.
Given that he's a utilitarian rationalist and he knows how to calculate the odds on things, he knows that the odds in this trial are that he's almost certainly toast.
Yes, he does. But you know what's interesting is his calculation of the odds are different than my calculation of the odds, or your calculation of the odds, I bet. So there are what we would call priors. Like what's the likelihood of anybody who's charged with a federal crime in the United States getting off? It's less than half of 1%. Last year, 77,000 cases get brought. 99.6% of them end in either a guilty plea or conviction.
Wow.
So if you do not want to be on the receiving end of the federal government in a criminal case. You just don't. It's stacked against you in all kinds of ways. Unlimited resources, greater powers than to call witnesses, a general prejudice from the judge usually. The jury thinks, why is the government bringing the case if it isn't true? You know, it's just like that one thing after another. So already I would have said, well, your prior, one in 200 is about as good as your odds are going to be. Are you in the pile of cases, are you more or less likely than the average case to be acquitted? Obviously less. Like you have three colleagues getting up and saying that you're guilty. You have the world hating you. Nobody believes your story. You're an author who just tells the story is attacked for telling the story rather than because he hasn't lynched you inside of his own in the book. This seems to me you are on the less likely end of the spectrum. So I would put the odds at 1 in 10,000.
So why not cut a deal?
He put the odds going in at 1 in 10.
Okay.
And he still puts the odds at he thinks he has, through lawyers, a 3% chance of getting off. So this tells you, what does this tell you? It tells you something about Sam Bankman-Fried, but it tells you something about assigning odds. It's a lot of BS in it. Like, you can just say the odds whatever are whatever you want them to be. And I don't know what his argument is, but it's not a good one. So he is over. So he misjudged, I think, his odds and in the first place. In the second place, and this is going to sound, you got to just believe me on this. I think he genuinely thinks he's innocent. He's behaved like he's behaved that way from the very beginning. Didn't try to run. I don't think he's hidden any money anywhere. Could be wrong about that. But he's put himself in harm's way right from the beginning and has basically taken the attitude with the government that I won't accept, maybe I accept 6 months of house arrest or something, but basically was not willing to even talk to them because he thought, I'm innocent. I'm gonna demonstrate my innocence. One thing he's doing that's really quixotic, he's going to testify. And defendants almost never do that, get up on the witness stand. He's so sure of this. So he has a different view of reality than everybody else. And that, I
think, and always has had?
Always has. Always. Yeah. Had. Yeah, I think so. So it's a, again, it's a peculiar situation, peculiar story.
So do you envisage a sequel or additional chapters?
I will certainly write something about the trial. And it's just... The judicial, it's been an interesting window for me on the judicial system. And if it gets a lot more interesting, maybe something longer than a afterword to the paperback.
The book is called Going Infinite, Rise and Fall of a New Tycoon by Michael Lewis. It's published by Alan Lane. Michael, thank you so much for
coming in
today.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today. Thanks very much to our producer, Declan Conlon, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. We will be back with you very soon indeed. But until then, goodbye and thanks for listening.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.